Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Georgia Stitt about her upcoming show at Subculture. We also do an Academy Awards wrap-up. Peter gives us his review on The Lion, a Culture Project, as well as Soho Rep's production of An Octoroon at Theater for New Audience. Please stay tuned.
Tightening my overcoat and waiting for contentment like a bus that never comes. Crushing my hat over angry hair, I beg my pocket for a cigarette. But instead I find a nickel and a crumpled little napkin with a poem for a lover I need to forget. There in every tear I shed when I don't think I'll make it through. The wanting of you, it is my unsurrendered prayer. I trace your hands upon my skin. How did I dare to let you in? It's almost more than I can bear. The wanting of you.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 1st, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being The Great Parade, which is going to be released on April 7th. Just, Peter, about 40 days from now, isn't it?
Can't come soon enough, and I'm talking about spring more than the book.
His columns appear at MCI Kritzerland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk on Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us, we have a very special guest. Georgia Stitt is joining us to talk about her upcoming show at Subculture. Georgia, why don't you tell us about that? Thanks for joining us on Broadway Radio.
Sure, thanks, James. Thanks for having me. Well, on March 9th, I am doing an evening, exactly what you just said, at Subculture, which is this great music listening room, this great venue downtown on Bleecker and Lafayette in New York City. And they, I've seen them do pop music. I've seen them do musical theater. I've seen them do classical music. They have a relationship with the New York Philharmonic and with the 92nd Street Y. And so, given the intimacy and the acoustics and the attention to sound in this room, I thought it would be a great opportunity to do some of my, art songs. Some of my more legit material. I have a degree in music composition, and when I was in college, I started writing art songs, studying poetry, and writing things that were somewhere, I would say, more classical than what you might be used to hearing from me. And then along the way, I became more and more of a Broadway girl, and somewhere in the middle is, I think, where my voice lies, that I write things that are poppy, but also sometimes things that are more classically inspired, pianistic, and harmonically interesting. Not the pop music isn't harmonically interesting, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I use this as an opportunity to revisit the Alphabet City Cycle, which is a song cycle that I wrote with Marcy Heisler as lyricist. And we wrote it for Kate Baldwin and hired Victoria Patterson as a violinist. And this was 2009 or so that we did this and recorded it and released it to the world. And I haven't performed it since. You know, the recordings are out there, and every now and I do a song here, a song there. Kate does a song here. But the whole cycle, we haven't done since there. It's about 20 minutes long. And so I asked Kate if she wanted to come to Subculture and revisit Alphabet City Cycle and sort of reinvent it for us. So we're not changing the music, but just sort of revisiting it now that we're older and wiser, hopefully. So then that seemed like an opportunity for me to think, what else is probably, you've got a 20-minute piece that is the linchpin of this program. What else have you got? And over the years, I have, you know, when I'm not writing a show, I'm not on deadline, I'll flip through books of poetry and I'll find something inspiring and set it. I've written choral music that way. I've written these just little standalone art songs that way. And on some of my albums, you'll hear these little pieces that go by. Some of them are short or some of them are, arty. And I thought, what if we put those all on the same evening? So that's what it is. It's I think people who enjoy classical singing will like it. I think people who enjoy Broadway singing will like it. And it's me figuring out how my music can, what I have to say to add to these beautiful words of these poets.
So on the Subculture website, which I'll link to in our show notes, it also says that Andrea Burns is coming, and Bradley Dean, and Rebecca Luker, and Kevin Simmons.
Yeah, so that's all the other material. So Kate is doing the song cycle. Kate Baldwin is doing the song cycle. And then as I pulled out all of these other pieces, I was able to build the rest of the evening around these different voices. Andrea Burns is doing The Holy Secret that she sang on my first album, and she's also doing a new song of mine called Palimpsest. And then I have this little funny, short song cycle. All of the songs are about 1 minute long, and she's learning those and premiering some of those songs. One of the most exciting things, I think, on the evening is that about 2 years ago, I wrote these songs for Rebecca Luker. I was asked to write songs for Rebecca Luker as a surprise. My friend Joel Fram, who is one of the city's great curators of music and of community, really, asked me to write these songs for Rebecca Luker. He was gathering many, many, many composers from the musical theater world to write things specifically for Rebecca Luker, to just show her our appreciation for her place in the industry. And apparently everyone that he asked said yes. He has over 100 songs that were written for Rebecca
Luker. Wow.
And so my two songs are in that mix of 100 songs. And, you know, selfishly, I thought, she's never going to get around to them. She's going to do Stephen Schwartz's songs first. I know she is. But I thought maybe I can ask her to learn these songs for my concert. And she did. And so these will be the world premiere of these two songs that I wrote for her. And I have to tell you, she came over yesterday to work on them for the first time. And I honestly have never had the experience where I write something for someone. So I imagine that person's voice in my head. And then when they show up for the first rehearsal, it's not to plunk out the melody and how does this go. She showed up with them memorized. And so the conversations we had were, do you like this phrasing better or that phrasing? I think this word is important, so is it okay if I do it this way? And like really intricate music-making questions. And at one point she said, oh, I'm sorry, my voice isn't really warmed up. And I was like, that's okay. My dreams are just coming true right now, so it's okay. You do whatever you want. I'm in heaven right now. A really magical experience to hear someone sing a piece that you wrote for them. The other fun thing that is on the there's Bradley Dean, who I have known for 10 or 12 years. We've done shows together and we've done concerts together. He's done readings of other pieces that I wrote. And I asked him to learn 3 art songs. He's doing a Derek Walcott poem. He's doing the Shakespeare sonnet that I wrote. And he's doing these two, which is the piece I wrote for my wedding. So that's fantastic. But the last little novel piece of the concert is my friend Kevin Simmons, who I have known since college. I was his accompanist when we were both 17 years old, 17, 18 years old. The very first two art songs I ever wrote when I was a sophomore in college, I set these two poems, and Kevin premiered them on my senior recital at Vanderbilt University. And no one has ever sung them since.
Wow.
And they have been buried. I was about to say on my computer, but they weren't even on my computer. They were handwritten. You know, they've been buried for a long time. And he has lived in San Francisco, and I lived in Los Angeles, and our paths have gone many different directions. And he just moved back to New York City, and I called him, and I was like, you must come and revisit these songs. It's been over 20 years since you sang them. And he came in, and there was one place where I had changed a note, and he was like, this is different. I was like, you remember that? Yes. So that has been a joy for me as well, to hear him find them. And again, you know, find them as adults, find them differently. And, you know, I had to practice because those songs are hard.
Talking about practicing,
yes.
You know, well, we're going to shift gears a little bit from the future of next Monday's show to maybe last Monday or so, and you had to practice all that parade stuff.
That's
that
right.
Evil man that wrote that stuff.
Right. Jason Robert Brown is a hard taskmaster. The history of this is that Jason Robert Brown is my husband, for anyone listening who doesn't know that, and we met because I auditioned to be the pianist, the assistant music director, on the national tour of Parade after it had its Lincoln Center run. It was going out on the road, and I auditioned for Jason to be the pianist on the road and got the job, fortunately, and went out on the road, and we call it a showmance, don't we, where you fall in love with someone on your show. and then thought that the tour was going to end and we were going to come back and go our separate ways, but it turned out we were actually meant to be together and we got married. And so that was in 2000 that happened. And so that I played the show many times. Tom Murray was the associate conductor of that tour, and he has since become Jason's music director. And so the three of us have been a pretty close family for many years. And as Jason was putting this concert together, we both thought it would be a great opportunity to reunite the beginnings of that world. I don't play shows anymore because now I'm raising children, and the idea of me being gone every night at 8 o'clock feels like too much of a compromise. That's not how I want to be making my living anymore. But a one night only concert that I could practice my tits off and then really do it amazingly seemed like a great opportunity. So it was really hard, and I thought that learning it would be like, oh, I just need to remind myself how this goes. It shouldn't be too hard. But in fact, it was, in many cases, it felt like starting over from scratch. There were a few things that were still in my fingers, but my fingers haven't played like that in a long time. And so it was really, really hard and really, really satisfying to be part of that evening. It was at Avery Fisher Hall, an orchestra, I think about a 30-piece orchestra, 226-voice choir, and like every perfectly cast Broadway person in every leading role, and it was sold out, Avery Fisher Hall. So it was, I said to Jason that night, I hope you know that this is as good as it gets, really.
I was just gonna
I'm not sure it gets much better than this, so I hope you realize that this is a pinnacle of your career, and that this is why we do it.
So it's all downhill?
Can have these moments. I mean, we'd love to do it every night and have it run for 6 years. Of course, that would be great. But even the one night only opportunity was very special.
Well, you know, the unique nature of that one night only and the point of view that you had from that from the position that you were in at that time, it's something that you have to share with others because nobody else can experience that.
Right.
You know, it's right. just amazing. So. And you mentioned that you were living in Los Angeles, and was it while you were out in Los Angeles you put that show together with Susan Egan?
Oh, yeah, that was while I was in Los Angeles. Yeah, Susan Egan and I performed together quite a bit. She was one of my gal pals and you know, just good friends, and then we had kids together at the same time. And I think for a while both of us felt like displaced New Yorkers, displaced Broadway people in Los Angeles, and we bound together over that. But then it also turned out that we built things together. So I played for her shows. She debuted a lot of music that I was writing during that time, and we built the show together. We were both pregnant with our second child at the same time, and so we put together an evening of material that some original pieces about being women and being moms and being wives and that sort of thing, but also songs that sound really funny when they come out of the mouth of a pregnant woman. Like we sang, you'll never get away from me, and I get a kick out of you, and I've got you under my skin. Fun things like that. And we called it All Knocked Up. That was fun. That's why you do cabaret, right?
Well, you know, that's hopefully why you do everything, because it's fun.
Right.
It's rewarding and fun. So our listeners, you can check out stuff that George is doing at georgiastitt.com. I'll have a link to that on the show notes, as well as the subculture thing, which is Georgia Stitt, Alphabet City Cycle, and other songs, which is coming up Monday, March 9th, 2015. And doors open at 7, and the show starts at 8, and it's general admission, so you want to get there early, you know, start camping out now. So
okay, there aren't very many bad seats. But if you want to be in a specific place, yes, get there early enough and put your coat over. This is mine.
Exactly. Georgia, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks, James. Thanks for having
me.
Thanks.
Curtains for the window and some daisies in a jar, and I have almost everything I need. So it's a bit dark, so it's a bit damp. I'll just close my eyes, pretending I'm
so Matt Tamanini, Broadway World's chief television and film critic, has joined us to give us a recap of what has happened with TV and film as it relates to Broadway. So, Matt, hello.
Hey, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Tell us, give us your recap on the Academy Awards. How did you feel it went?
Well, there's so much. Obviously, It's a pretty long endeavor from I think it started at 8:30 and didn't end until close to midnight. So there was a lot that went on. And so there are obviously some good things and some not so good things. Overall, I thought it was an awards show. The bones are so consistent from year to year that you're not going to get a lot different in any given ceremony. However, the things that changed are the performances and the host. So I was up and down with Neil Patrick Harris as the host. Some of the performances I thought were great. Some of them were, time for me to go get another snack or go to the bathroom. But I think like most of these award ceremonies, there were highs and lows.
Yeah, we talked briefly online about the length of this thing. I had mentioned that, I think it was like 11:56 p.m. I posted on Facebook that CBS would have cut this off an hour ago.
Yeah.
And yep. Maybe CBS is doing everybody a favor by cutting it off at 11.
Yes. Yes.
And what is the good length there, and when do you lose everybody? So,
right. Well, I think it's true for all awards shows, especially, for Broadway radio listeners, something like the Tony Awards, where you still want to recognize the achievement of the people behind the scenes, whether that's the cinematographer or editor at the Academy Awards or the lighting and sound people at the Tonys. You want to be able to recognize their achievement because these are professionals that dramatically contribute to the entertainment value that you get. But most people don't know who they are. We don't know who the director is of the foreign language short film. So it's not something that necessarily people are going to be really dying to tune into for a television broadcast. And so for me, that's where I kind of go back and forth. I appreciate the fact that they get recognized on a large scale. But when it comes down to it for CBS with the Tonys or whoever gets the Academy Awards on a certain year, it is a television show. And I think that if they aren't cognizant of that fact over the next few years, they could really see ratings decline. I mean, it's something where with the proliferation of entertainment online and on cable, it might not be the appointment television that it has been over the last few years.
So back, I don't even know how many years ago, the first hour of the Tony Awards used to be broadcast on PBS, and we've talked about it a number of times with Peter and Michael and various other folks on the broadcast. I really enjoyed that. I wondered if the Academy Awards can go for some of those lesser known awards, just a straight online stream or some other type of e-entertainment network. Certainly that's much better than giving the Kardashians $100 million
or the horrendous red carpet show where people drop racial and ethnic slurs like happened this year. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think you still give the opportunity for those incredible artists to be recognized and to celebrate their achievements without making the general public, who might not be even be aware of those awards, have to sit through them to get to the stuff they actually want to tune in and watch. Because if they get bored, the people who aren't extremely invested in the awards that are given out later in the night, chances are pretty good that all they're going to do is they're going to click the channel over to a Walking Dead marathon on AMC instead.
So, tell us what else happened. What was your opinion on Neil Patrick Harris's performance? He's so tied into Broadway.
Yeah, I think there were some really great stuff. Obviously, Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez wrote the opening number, Moving Pictures, which I thought was a pretty good when it comes to Academy Award opening numbers. People you see online complaining, oh, when did this turn into the Tonys? But lest you forget that there's almost always an opening number on the Academy Awards, whether it's Seth MacFarlane hosting, Hugh Jackman, Billy Crystal, there's almost always an opening number. So Moving Pictures, I thought it was fine. I'm not sure that people who weren't as familiar with Into the Woods maybe got Jack Black coming up and doing a version of the Witch's Rap. I don't know that that was the Lopez's best work, but in terms of Academy Award opening numbers, it was pretty solid, I thought. Some of the jokes that he had throughout the night, I was pretty uncomfortable with. There was two or three jokes that I thought crossed the line on good taste. But for the most part, the jokes seemed to fit Neil Patrick Harris's humor. If you follow him on Twitter or see him in interviews, he's a pretty dry guy. Lots of little quips, little one-liners. I thought it, you know, for the most part, it was pretty funny. It did not seem like the opinion in the room at the Dolby Theater kind of agreed with that. It seemed like a lot of his jokes were bombing, you know, which was disappointing because I laughed quite a bit. But it didn't seem like it worked. And I'm not sure that there's a lot of people that can work that room. There is so much ego and everything in that room that it's tough for them to laugh at themselves. And that's always been the case. I mean, when you have Ellen DeGeneres, who hosted last year, who is one of the most beloved comedians, if not the most beloved comedian and host in the country, and she even struggled at times last year. So I think it's a big ask to have anybody, you know, completely win over that room. But I thought he did well. Like I said, there were a couple jokes that I thought were ill-advised, but for the most part, he was as charming as ever. The one ongoing bit that definitely I didn't think worked, and I think 99.9% of people agreed with, was his predictions in the locked box. You know, when it came down to it, that was more or less a rap-free version of his of the recap he did of the Tonys with Lin-Manuel Miranda a couple years ago. That's basically the same bit without the rapping, and it just didn't work. Like you said, after 3.5 hours, getting close to midnight, we got it. We remember what happened. We were watching too. We don't need you to recap it for us. But overall, I thought he was, you know, I don't think he killed it as much as we would have liked, but he was as solid and entertaining, as charismatic as you would expect him to be.
So how about Lady Gaga?
Oh my God. I think that, you know, last year they talked about Ellen's celebrity-filled selfie breaking the internet. I think Lady Gaga at least broke the theater internet, because everybody on social media was talking about that instantly. And for Broadway World on Sunday night, I was posting all the videos of the performances. So I was tied in pretty quick to getting those things up as fast as possible, and then kind of seeing how they took off. That article with that video is still generating a massive amount of page views and social interaction. People who liked Lady Gaga are saying, look at her. We knew it. She was great. She's talented. She's not just, you know, a kind of out there character. And the people who might not have been a fan of Lady Gaga before are very much expressing surprise and pleasure at not only how talented she is, because I think a lot of people understand that behind the, you know, slab of meat dress that she likes to wear, she's a talented performer. But I think a lot of people were pleased and impressed that she was able to give a fairly straightforward, respectful performance of these songs that means so much to so many people. So I think that was a huge thing for her. I mean, I think now that Lady Gaga has become a bona fide international celebrity, she's able to do things that appeal to her outside of that shock and awe pop music mentality. When you've got cheek to cheek with Tony Bennett and giving a great performance of these old Broadway standards on the Academy Awards, I think we're starting to see a little bit more of where her artistic sensibilities are beyond the flash and show. So it did great. She's gotten, you know, great comments from Julie Andrews, who obviously came out and embraced her afterwards. And today, the actual granddaughter of the real Maria Von Trapp said the performance was exquisite. So, you know, it's one of those things that's crossed all boundaries. But of course, as I'm sure you've seen, everybody in the theater community immediately started dream casting her in every musical, from Evita to Funny Girl and everything in between.
And she, her fans are called monsters. Is that what she calls them?
Yes, that was one of her a reference to one of her first singles. Yes.
So, you know, these monster fans, I think, would give the Jackies and the Rentheads and the various Broadway fans a run for their money there.
Yeah, there's no doubt they are a special breed. But with a name like Monsters following a superstar named Lady Gaga, you would expect them to be a little passionate and outside the box.
So over the years, we get very nervous on the Monday and Tuesday after the Tony Awards because the ratings come out and everybody frets and hems and haws about the ratings. But as we see, you know, a lot of a lot of awards type shows, whether it be the Grammys or the Emmys or the Tonys or the Academy Oscars, the Academy Awards, they all are suffering in the ratings, aren't they?
Well, this year especially, the Academy Awards have been seeing yearly gains for the last 4 years, and this year was a marked drop from that. It is still doing fairly well, but it dropped about 6 million viewers, which was about 15% from last year. It's the lowest it's been since 2011. But it's you know, when I look at it, I look at not just, okay, the easy person to blame is Neil Patrick Harris. But when you look at it and you compare the films that are nominated and the actors that are nominated, you know, as much as I think a lot of people enjoyed these movies and there's some B plus list stars, there weren't any, you know, not as many mega stars as in years past. I mean, if you look at last year, there was obviously Matthew McConaughey and Sandra Bullock and Christian Bale and Leonardo DiCaprio. And obviously Bradley Cooper was nominated 2 years in a row. And you had Jennifer Lawrence and Julia Roberts. You had huge A-list stars nominated. And with those people involved in the ceremony and then getting awards later into the night, you're going to have a little bit more of those fans sticking around for the long haul. This year you had, you know, Cooper and you had Reese Witherspoon and Julianne Moore and Steve Carell and Emma Stone and Keira Knightley, I guess. But, you know, those stars don't necessarily rise to the level of the ones from last year. So I think the ratings decline is as much a decline in the nominees as it was the host. Similarly, the Golden Globes and the Grammys were both down this year after having years of gains. So I think it's a cyclical thing that has as much to do with the nominees as well as the state of television as compared to just something specifically about this year's host or this year's producers, which are usually the ones who get the blame.
So did you see Birdman?
I did. Loved Birdman, yeah.
So tell the folks who haven't seen Birdman what the tie-in with Birdman into Broadway is.
Well, Birdman is basically it's an incredible movie. And if you haven't seen it, obviously, you know, it won the Best Picture. So I highly recommend it. But Birdman is a story of an actor played by Michael Keaton, who a few decades before had been a huge movie star playing Birdman, who was the central figure in a comic book superhero franchise, which, ironically, not that different from Michael Keaton in real life. Like Michael Keaton, the character Riggins, he turns down doing another sequel of Birdman because he wants to pursue some other more challenging, more artfully satisfying roles. And then his career never really rebounds from that. What he's doing in Birdman is he is writing, producing, and directing and acting in a Broadway play to try to revive his credibility as an artist. And the way that this movie is filmed is as theatrical as it possibly can be. The cinematography of it makes about 75% to 80% of the film appear as if it was done in one long tracking shot. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what a tracking shot is, it just think of any Aaron Sorkin TV show,
Walk and Talk,
and the Walk and Talk. Yeah, if you see Birdman, it looks like 75% of the film is one long Walk and Talk. Now, you obviously can tell that that's not the case because sometimes it goes from nighttime to daytime in the middle of a tracking shot, so you know that there's other things going on. But a lot of it actually was done as a long tracking shot, and there's some really cool behind the scenes videos online of how they had to maneuver behind or in the hallways of the St. James Theater, where a lot of it was actually filmed. So it was filmed in a Broadway house, and there was obviously some sets created to look like that as well, and some other stuff. But it was filmed in a Broadway theater, set in a Broadway theater, about a Broadway play and Broadway actors. So there was quite a bit of connection between that Best Picture winning movie and the theater.
So get out there and check it out.
Yeah,
it's a really good movie, as Matt had mentioned.
Did you see it, James?
Yeah.
It's, and you liked it as well, then?
Oh, I did. I really did. And it's fun to, it's even more fun to see, you know, a hallway and you're like, hey, wait, I know that hallway. I've been there. You know, it's very fun.
Well, not all of us get to go backstage at the St. James like you do, James. So
I was looking for the bathroom. I got lost.
Oh, right. Sure. You're. So, uh-huh. Yeah.
looking for the bathroom and getting lost. Talking about that, we're going to shift gears away from the Academy Awards and head over to our girl, Megan Hilty, who's got a new television show. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she it just was announced today. We're talking on Thursday. She is going to be the star of an ABC comedy pilot. Doesn't have a name yet, but it's a single camera comedy where she basically plays a Tony winning actress who has kind of settled down as a suburban mother, and her very intelligent, risk averse husband have realized that their son is an incredibly talented athlete. So Megan's character, whose name is Irene, who, and I'll read this exactly as the press release is, so you can decide if you can picture who, what Tony winning actress you think they might be referencing here. But she's described as a loud, flamboyant diva, a former Broadway star who is adjusting to her latest role as a suburban mom. So if you can imagine any loud, flamboyant Broadway divas, that's the vein that Megan's character will be. And they try to navigate the world of highly competitive youth athletics. So pretty interesting. You know, I when I first heard it, the very vague description, I was thinking about Nathan Lane's failed TV show where I think he played an opera star or something.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So when I realized that the plot was not going to be about her being a former star, but rather the family dynamic, that made me a little more interested in this concept. So I'm excited to see how it goes. Obviously, anybody who follows theater actors on Twitter knows that it's pilot season and a lot of them are out in LA doing pilots or trying to get signed for pilots. So this is one that'll be interesting to see how it develops. I remember when Smash was starting, Megan said that, you know, she'd never really been a Broadway superstar. You know, she was in 9 to 5 as in the original cast, and she replaced in Wicked, but she was never the big headliner. So she said, I'm gonna have to go do TV so I can be a Broadway star. But it seems between this and the Sean Hayes show and Smash that she's found a home in television, whether it's permanent or not. So if this is where she's wanting her career to go, I wish her the best. And if nothing else, it's just a, like we talk about a lot, another chance to see a theater star on television every week.
Yeah, no, it's gonna, you know, I think, I don't know if there's any data to support this, but it seems like Broadway folks are having a much easier time of it going back and forth between television and film and back to Broadway as it was in the past. I could be totally wrong about that, but
well, I've talked to a couple actors like that, John Ellison Conley and Thomas Sadowski. I've interviewed them. I've talked to them about it, and they said a lot of that has to do with one, a lot of the tax incentives that have come to New York that allow production companies to have a more financially beneficial time filming in New York. So a lot of the shows that actually are set in New York can be filmed there, which allow theater actors to kind of go back and forth without having to crisscross the country to audition or to film or whatever. But even beyond that, people like Andrew Rannells, who we've seen on TV in his own show that I can't remember the name of it, but that and then Girls and kind of going back and forth. But I think you're right. It's a good time to be a theater actor who wants to dabble in television and movies.
All right. So anything else you want to mention before you run off into the sunset?
No, it's not sunny here, but it's much warmer here in Central Florida than it is in New York. So I apologize. I apologize to all the snow laden, all the snow laden listeners, but, that's about all I got. I did see, speaking of snow, I mentioned I'm going to see Motown here in a couple weeks, but last week I saw a touring production that's not necessarily theater, but it's Slava's Snow Show. Have you heard of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're in the snow already, don't bother having to go feel like you check this one out. This was a mess. It was frighteningly bad.
Wasn't for you?
No. And, you know, I'm like I said, I'm in Orlando. So we've got Cirque du Soleil here. We've got Blue Man Group here. So Orlando knows how to do clowns well. And that's what Slava Snow Show is. It's a clown show. And man, I just I don't know. I didn't get it. I don't think the audience got it. And I don't think there's actually very big audiences for it here. So I don't want to downplay that. But that was, if that comes to town, that might be one that I say go rent Birdman and watch that instead.
All right, Matt. Well, thanks for joining us. And we'll have you back in a couple of weeks and we'll catch up then. Okay.
Sounds great. Talk to you later, James.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
All right. So, we just finished up the little segment with Matt Tamanini on the Academy Awards, but now Peter and Michael have joined us. Did you guys have anything to say about the Academy Awards? Michael, what'd you think?
Well, I noticed the theater connections. Of course, there are always some, but one of the two things. Alex Di Nolaris, who's one of the people who wrote for the screenplay of Birdman, has been known for several shows off Broadway. And so I actually know him slightly. So it was really great to see him up there because I had not heard that he was even involved in Birdman until the nominations came out. I hadn't noticed the screenplay credit.
Yeah.
So that was really nice to see, you know, and I'm sure that he's thrilled about that. And the other thing was that one of the commercials, and I can't remember actually what the product is, maybe Peter remembers. It's something big, though, something really big. But one of the commercials on the Oscars and that I've heard and seen several times recently features the song Feeling Good, which is a Broadway show tune.
Yes, indeed. From the roar of the grease, paint the smell of the crowd, which will soon be having its 50th anniversary of opening at the Schubert Theater. What I noticed, of course, was the meteoric rise of J.K. Simmons, who we used to see in moderately small, moderately large parts on Broadway, especially in the famous 1992 revival of Guys and Dolls, where he played Benny South Street. He was also in Laughter on the 23rd Floor and was in one of those, I think, Kathy Rigby revivals of Peter Pan when he played both Mr. Darling and Captain Hook. So it was nice to see somebody whose roots are in the theater getting an Oscar. Not that that's so uncommon, I'm happy to say, but it's nice to see it happen. Also, the opening number, which was terrific, came courtesy of Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. So that was nice, too, that they that last year's Oscar winners got to do this year's opening song.
J.K. Simmons was also in Birds of Paradise.
Oh, that's very interesting, because I always brag about the fact that I noticed Donna Murphy in Birds of Paradise, and I always crow about it, you know, that I noticed her when nobody else did, because I wrote about how that was the best performance of the season in a featured role in a musical and so on. But I didn't notice J.K. Simmons in it, so there I am. You can't notice everybody.
And another off-Broadway flop musical that I can't remember at the moment, but he was working a lot. And look, isn't that great when someone like that, just, you know, who really has put in their dues and been just, you know, a great journeyman actor, singer, whatever, and then they wind up getting an Oscar at this point in their career.
Sure, sure. It is very gratifying whenever that happens. But
I'm sorry. Did he win or was he just nominated?
I'm sorry, I'm confused. What are you...
J.K. Simmons.
He won.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't saying the wrong thing.
No, the wrong thing being said is my department. So,
I'm not always.
Did you guys happen to catch that the Lady Gaga segment on Sound of Music?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
So
most people seem to like it. I'm going to be very honest with you. I had a friend who was nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short Subject, and she won. And I will be perfectly honest that after she gave her acceptance speech, I turned off the show. that's all I wanted to see. That's all I was concerned with. Ellen Gusenberg Kent, who did something on Suicide Crisis Hotline. And that's all I was interested in seeing. And after that, I went back to work. I had a lot of things to write. So I didn't see the rest of the show. And I didn't see the Lady Gaga sequence, although I know it's very easy to find on the internet. But it's been so controversial at this point, I've stayed away from it. So, Michael, you didn't like it?
Oh, no, I thought she was quite wonderful.
Oh, okay. All right.
Though I have to say, you know, I hate to beat a dead horse. I was incredibly distracted by those two huge tattoos on her, both of her underarms. Yeah. You know, but when you're singing a classic song like that and you're wearing a strapless gown, yeah. Not a sleeveless gown.
Yeah.
You know, so I wish I just don't like that. but singing wise, you know, and the fact, I mean, I think she has a great respect for that kind of material. I mean, as she's already proven in her work with Tony Bennett. And I thought she was great. I thought the orchestrations were wonderful. And then one of the reasons you should watch it, Peter, is that when Julie Andrews comes out at the end, there is such an outpouring of love from the audience.
Oh, that's
I mean,
nice.
you can just feel it. And there's a great moment where, you know, I mean, there is some incongruity there in Lady Gaga being followed by Julie Andrews.
Sure.
And so she comes out and there's this huge ovation and people stand up and, you know, it goes on for about a minute. And then finally people quiet down and Julie says, "Oh, thank you, Lady Gaga." And the audience kind of laughs because it's so sweet and cute and incongruous. It was wonderful.
All right, so let's move forward into our reviews of Legit, as they see in Variety. Mm-hmm. Peter got a chance to see The Lion at the Culture Project down at 45 Bleecker Street. Michael talked about it last week, but Peter, what was your take on it?
Well, I thought it was quite good. Susanna Bowling, who has a TV show, every time I ran into her, she would say to me, "Have you seen The Lion? Why aren't you with the Lion?" So finally I had to, all right, don't hit me anymore. I'll go see the Lion. I wasn't sure I was going to like it, but I certainly did. Benjamin Schuer, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Schuer?
S-C-H-E-U-E-R. It's a one-man show. He's buttressed by a number of guitars or stringed instruments, and he plays them quite well. It's his own story of growing up with a father who could be difficult. And part of the story, too, is his bout with cancer, which we know he succeeded in beating, given the fact that he's up there and has a nice, healthy head of hair, I'm happy to say. But that's what it deals with. I will admit that when watching the show and his talking about his father, I wanted to hear the other side of the story. As we all know, there's his side, the truth. You know what I mean? And I really felt that there was a bit of skewering there, that we were hearing his perceptions, and it might not be 100% accurate. I will admit that. What astonished me was that here's a pop songwriter. Here we go again. You know what I'm going to say. Perfect rhymes.
Yep.
it was astonishing. Everyone. I don't think he missed one at all. I mean, this guy uses a rhyming dictionary or just has this talent. But I was very delighted to hear that because, of course, lyrics land better when there are perfect rhymes. So he did that for a very engaging performer, very nice, a quick 90-minute show, but very, very pleasurable, and I'm delighted that Susanna made me go.
I thought the music and lyrics were extraordinary also. I thought they were in a different way, really, than you normally hear. It was like some kind of perfect melding of folk-type songs and musical theater.
Theater, right, yes,
Yeah. I thought that I had one issue with it, which, of course, through no fault of his own, did you notice, Peter? I'm sure you did, that one of the plot points is extremely similar to Billy Crystal's show.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. Sure. That they had an issue just before he died. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, again, that's no fault of his own. But I also thought he was very charming and compelling. His guitar playing is phenomenal from my point of view. I'm not an expert on guitar playing, but I can't imagine anyone playing the guitar better than him. I did think he wasn't really necessarily the greatest actor in the way that we normally think of it. And it's funny, I saw a show last night and these two guys were sitting next to me and I guess they had seen it and they were talking, one of them was talking and I eavesdropped a little bit and he mentioned a criticism, which I have to agree with. There was through a lot of it, Benjamin just kind of has a sort of a smile on his face, like a kind of middle of the road Road smile, almost, I won't say smirk, but it's just kind of like his default expression for performing. And that didn't always fit with the lyrics. But people are loving it. People are really adoring it. And I can see why, because I do think that there was exceptional ability and talent in the lyrics and the music.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Peter also got a chance to see Soho Rep's production of An Octoroon, which was in Brooklyn, wasn't it, Peter?
Yeah, it's moved to Theater for the New Audience, that very pretty new complex near Nevin Street, at least if you take the 2 or 3 train, that's where you get off. DeKalb Avenue, too, if you want to take the D. It's worth the trip. It really is. Yeah, it's strange. Here's a play that's based on a 19th century hit. It was first produced in 1859. Dion Boucicault wrote this play. And now a young playwright, Brandon Jacob Jenkins, has fooled around with it. And that's not a criticism. It's even a compliment, because what we're seeing is how people reacted in those days to plays that involved slavery. Remember, 1859 means we still have slavery in this country. So as a result, the way that the slaves are portrayed in this play is pretty horrifying. So Brandon Jacob Jenkins spins things on their ears and makes it funny in a strange way. So in a way, this reminds me of Springtime for Hitler, in the sense that, I don't mean it's a bad show, but just as Mel Brooks figured the best defense against history's most famous madman was to laugh at him, the playwright feels the best way to go in mocking this play is to treat slavery as a matter of fact, fact of life. So he actually starts the show. Not, I don't mean he himself, but he's got a character named BJJ, which of course stands for him. And he explains what he's up to. And he says things like sympathy, compassion, and understanding is what we learn from the theater. And but ideally, that I hope he's right. But he delivers on that promise, though. So he adds some contemporary references. Two women talk about attending a slave mixer, you know, that type of this weekend. So, the plot itself deals with a guy named George who loves Zoe, and he's hampered because she's 1/8 black, that the octoroon, and that's more than enough to keep them from marrying. So, so that's the main plot, but the stuff about slavery keeps on coming in as you watch these people, and you feel so terrible for them, even though they're so inured to their situation that it's illegal for a slave to read, that you could be sold at a moment's notice. People can be torn apart, families. And seeing these people worry about being torn apart, yes, but they also worry even if they're single, because they really feel, not that this is said in this way, the master you know is better than the master you don't know. So it was a fascinating thing to watch this audience, because the audience was laughing like crazy, and then it would be stunned into sober silence. Because all of a sudden, it wasn't funny anymore to watch these slaves in misery or being treated terribly. Back and forth, it goes from comedy to drama very, very skillfully. So that's what's really wonderful about it. Also, there's a very funny thing involving snow, which I dare say you've never seen before. So even for that alone, it's fun to go and see what they do with snow. And how it impacts the audience. So take a look at that. So I recommend this very, very highly. And not only that, I do think that the director, Sarah Benson, has done a splendid job of staging. It's a long show, but it didn't really feel it because it was so slickly done. And you really become immersed in these two-dimensional characters, purposely kept two-dimensional because that's the way they were originally written. And suddenly, Brandon Jacob Jenkins is able to make them, well, maybe 2.5 to 2.75 dimensional. And that really does pack a wallop.
Wow. So
get thee on a 2 and 3 of the D train down to go see this.
Nice theater, very pretty, and nice atmosphere too. It was fun to see so many young people there. I mean, what's happening, of course, in Brooklyn, you don't need me to tell you, is amazing. But the area is really coming up in the world, and this is one of the reasons why. It's very close to some of the BAM theaters too. So if you know your way around there, it's not far to get to this handsome glass building with a very nice cafe and tables. And there's just an ambiance of something really special happening there, and that's what's really wonderful about it.
So theater for a new audience, are they developing new audiences by doing a show like an Octoroon?
I think they're developing new audiences. I think it seemed to me that the crowd that was there just comes there to see whatever they're offered. Two Gentlemen of Verona, not the musical. The play will be next up there, and I expect to see as many people there for a Shakespeare play as I do for this one.
Okay, I guess that wraps it up for this week. So before we get to our trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. So, Peter, last week's trivia question was about songs they had.
Right. What was the commonality between It Takes a Woman in Hello, Dolly, and She Wasn't You from On a Clear Day You Can See Forever? And the answer is that even though the first one deals with a woman and is usually sung by Horace Vander Gelder, and while the second one is She Wasn't You, both of these songs were refitted for Barbara Streisand in the movie versions of Hello, Dolly and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, because Streisand indeed did sing It Takes a Woman. Walter Matthau did too. But she got to reprise it, and She Wasn't You became He Wasn't You in the movie On a Clear Day, once again proving how they give, or Streisand takes, whichever it is, any opportunity to get more material. So that was last week's trivia question. This week's: a composer of a Broadway musical that ran one night was known by a name that is included in the name of a Broadway play that ran one night. What's the word, the full name of the composer, his show, and the play that ran a single performance?
That's complex.
Okay.
All right. So if you do have that information, go to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, and let us know what you think. We have also links to some of the things we've talked about at the show today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And a tear to the sweet softness of once familiar skin, and the map of love my fingers still trace in the long ago. I wanted to hold.